CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, Interim Management and Executive Placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney services as outstanding and excellent. National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors, whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News comes to us by chiefexecutive.net, and it's entitled, Why Do Volatile CEOs Have Nine Lives? Rather interesting title, and this was written by David Brookmeyer. And the article goes on like this. Are you surprised when you see a volatile, high-profile CEO fired from one company and then hired by another? To make matters worse, even when they're abrasive or abusive, these star CEOs negotiate quite lucrative severance packages and often leave their company with tens of millions of company funds and stock. Most recent examples include HP's Leo Apotheker, $13.2 million, Yahoo's Carol Bartz with $10 million, and Burger King's John Chidsey with $20 million. So how do CEO leaders who have failed on the public stage land new CEO jobs in other companies? What is it about CEOs that creates a near immunity to damage? Well, there's a very common employee selection tenet that has existed for decades. The best predictor of future performance is past performance. There are several reasons that CEOs have been fired can land in their new roles with other companies. These have to do with the process, candidates, and the board of directors. The candidate pool for CEOs, much like CFOs, is very limited. Additionally, the CEO role has become increasingly risky and complex, with 24/7 demands of their time that are undesirable for many executives. Also, selection committees lack qualified candidates. This is partly fueled by the common perception that only a few people actually have the skills to become a CEO. Couple that with the need for industry experience, and the pool shrinks quickly for most open CEO jobs. And you reduce the risk if you hire someone that has previously held a CEO position. So compounding the problem, internal succession plans have been a hit or miss at best. Promoting from the inside sometimes takes too long, and many companies just don't want to spend the time training an internal candidate. The problem is exacerbated if the CEO departure is sudden, as in many cases with failed leaders. The selection process has many potential flaws. Just because you served on a board doesn't mean to say that you have skills in talent management. Many hiring processes depend on who you know. Board members may serve on multiple boards, networking and building relationships. Ken Langone helped recruit and hire GE's Bob Nardelli to Home Depot as he served on both boards. It's difficult to find out really what happened with CEO's performance at the previous job due to confidentiality agreements and the fear of defamation lawsuits. Even if a CEO was abusive in their last position, there's often a positive halo effect for executives who've had good press and served in strong brands in the past. CEOs also don't have an accurate perception of their own strengths, and many CEOs can do very well in the job interview with their leadership communications and other skills that help rise them in the ranks. There's tremendous pressure on boards to act responsibly and help the company be successful, but when was the last time you witnessed a board member actually volunteering to be trained on behavioral interviewing? And often the need for financial results apparently trumps performance, judgment, and ethics. There are intense pressures to expeditiously fill the CEO vacancy due to increased stock volatility, opportunity costs, shareholder pressures, company morale, and so on. Hiring the right CEO can increase stock prices, at least in the short term. For instance, Oracle's stock price went up 5% alone when it was announced Mark Hurd was hired. And making a hiring mistake in the C-suite is very costly. Nat Stoddard and Claire Wyckoff reported in their estimation that the costs of CEO hiring mistakes for replacing large cap, mid cap, and small cap company CEOs were $52 million, 22 million and 12 million, respectively. So why do these volatile CEOs get rehired again? Their previous experience is valuable and eases concerns for board members. These CEOs have a lot in common, including some fatal flaws that caused them to fail in their previous CEO position. And these include, number one, weak CEO functional skills. Two, big blind spots and gaps in their own leadership skills. Three, lapses in judgment. And finally, four, poor ethics. So this article concludes, what can companies do to ensure their CEO hiring is effective and avoid these costly mistakes? First and foremost, focus on building the leadership pipeline, and that is a strong component of succession planning. Two, provide executive coaches for the CEO to make sure that he or her has the best opportunity for success. Three, address the selection process problems. There are many problems in most current selection processes, all of which can be addressed for improvements in the final selection decisions. And finally, educate and develop the board. CEO hiring doesn't happen that often, but when it does, the costs for poor hiring are tremendous. Well, we'd like to thank our contributor for that article. It is very much most timely. And chiefexecutive.net is right on. In fact, today's guest, we have Rick Patterson joining us today, and I'm thrilled to have Rick joining us. Rick is the Vice President of Best Work Data, otherwise known as BWD, a company that uses the latest science and expertise to measure how people think, learn, and behave, and then links that data to help companies make hiring decisions to actionable decisions in all aspects of human capital management strategy. Rick's background is a blend of operational experience, sales, and sales management over 25 years of owning and operating multiple businesses, including in wholesale manufacturing distribution, multiple retail store operations, executive recruitment, and career management consultative services. Rick's primary responsibility today is sales and business development, promoting the value proposition of BWD business model, while assisting in implementing marketing and branding strategies for future growth. Rick attended the University of Cincinnati and Oakland University. He's interested in the growth of environmental sustainability and serves on several committees for local charity events. Rick believes the prosperity of any organization lies in the quality of its people and the importance of an effective strategy that supports that ideal. Well, my goodness, Rick, what a great background. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lorraine. Thank you for having me this morning. I really appreciate you reaching out to me and inviting me in this morning.
Well, let's start at the beginning, Rick. We ask our guests the same first question. What was your first job, whether paid or unpaid?
That's a great question to start off because growing up, my family moved around a lot in the 50s and 60s, and so we bounced around quite a bit. And one of the very first things I can remember growing up is my dad was a very accomplished gardener and loved the outdoors and loved taking care of the greenery around the house and everything. So he was really particular about that. And back in the early 50s and 60s, we didn't have a whole lot of like Home Depots around to go out and get various different things. So he always charged me with going out and pulling weeds, right, in the yard. So I can remember many, many Saturday mornings out there on my knees with the little, handled weed, scooper outer.
Weed scoop.
Right, right. Pulling out, dandelions and crabgrass and things like that. That was probably one of the not really desirable jobs I got charged with growing up. But I can
rain
remember
or shine, right?
Rain or shine. And, normally he would say, okay, this weekend you have to spend some hours out there. And I would wait and wait and wait. And it was on Sunday afternoon before dinner, I'd have to go spend a couple hours out in the yard doing that around the yard. So that was one of the things I can remember early on.
So I guess that probably gave you some pretty good strong back muscles, huh?
Well, I don't know. It was pretty repetitive, and I hated that aspect of it.
Well, that being said, your dad probably had a very good hiring technique. Pressure and bullying tactics is one of the forms of leadership that seems to work in some instances. But we've got you on the show today to talk a lot about the function for CFOs and, I guess, more broadly for leadership to be able to make the right hiring decisions, but then also to help motivate and continue to have the right teams in the right place and so forth. Before we get into that, I want to know how we get from gardening to Rick today. Draw me through those time periods.
Well, really quickly, without going into too much detail, my dad was a pretty good salesman, taught me a lot of things in life. And so later on in his career, he decided to go entrepreneurial and start a company. And he wanted me to go work for him. So I did during the summertime and college weekends and things like that. And then I came back from college and went to work for him. And unfortunately, shortly after that, he passed away. And I took his company over at age 23. And then that kind of started me on my entrepreneurial blend. So I built his company from the early 80s to the late 80s and sold it. And then moved down to Georgia and started another manufacturer's rep firm. In Michigan, it was all automotive, and then when I moved down here and started another one, I decided something a little more diverse, so it was aviation and technology and sort of some specific niche in manufacturing. And we did really, really well for a number of years until 9/11 came along, and that kind of shut the faucet off and made me kind of readjust where I was going. So I got involved in some retail development and opened three retail opportunities and managed those, and at the same time bought a wholesale manufacturing company and ran that and grew that, and I've sold all those entities off since then. And then in the meantime after that, I got involved in being on some investment teams and some interesting opportunities where we were helping people raise money, and got introduced to a couple of people in the executive recruiting and executive outplacement business, and got involved in that for a while. And then just led me to this opportunity today where, you know, it's still in the human capital strategy, helping companies grow from a human capital strategy standpoint, because all the businesses I've ever run, you know, the people in your business are everything. You could have the best product and service on the planet, and if you don't have the right people in the right place doing the right things and led well, you're not going to maintain good business. So that's kind of like, you know, sort of not my pet peeve, but sort of like my, you know, I think that's what makes companies run, and I try to do everything I can and bring things to the table to help companies, you know, make sure that they implement right and find the right strategies and manage correctly and put people in the place where they'll be successful.
And you know, I noticed along the way that one of your opportunities that you had mentioned was investing in some other companies. Very often when we've spoken to investors, and certainly in my business life, investors say that the decision that they take to invest is based on the individual and based on the trust that has been built through the dialogue that has occurred. And that is a very remarkable and finely tuned leadership skill to select the person in whom you can put that trust. And so is that also a part of the collaboration that you've had? I mean, a lot of it has been human capital related.
Well, actually, I don't really invest in companies. I'm on an investment team to help people go find money. So it was a little different take on that. And some's been in real estate and a couple been in film. You know, the film industry and launching some really interesting, you know, film ventures in that respect. So that's where I've kind of played. I hold my cash kind of close to my chest and don't really, like, you know, venture out too far. I have invested in a few things, and it looks like one's going to come to fruition in a couple of months, which looks really interesting.
Well, maybe we'll have you back on the show to talk about that one.
Well, you may have to get me from the Caribbean, because that's where I'll be.
Well, let's talk about the role of the leader, including the CFO, in hiring the right people. What are the key areas, perhaps, in the beginning of our dialogue today that the CFO should focus upon?
Well, I think in the beginning, if a CFO is going to be hiring people for his team or hiring people under him or finding the right job fit for somebody coming in to his organization, I think he needs to do, first of all, he needs to find the landscape of his own people. He needs to understand what the balance sheet of his human capital is in his business so that, you know, he understands the makeup of his own team before he even thinks about bringing somebody in.
And how do you do that?
Well, you know, you do it from various ways. You can do it by interviewing. You can do it in testing. You can do, you know, team building exercises. You can do a lot of things to find out how your people work, learn, and behave. And, you know, everybody's take on that could be a little different. You know, we're all, we all interview and talk to people on, you know, from emotional standpoint and an observation standpoint, you know. And most people in the hiring practice, if they're not really, really great interviewers, if they're not trained and, you know, really, really good, they hire, you know, they like to hire people like them. Mm-hmm, which is typically a mistake.
Mm-hmm. And you know, in accounting and finance school, we tend not to be taught leadership. We tend not to be taught hiring, and we tend not to be taught too much about behavior and motivation. And that's a strong element of what you're referring to, I think.
I think it is. And in retrospect, you have to kind of think like, you know, a lot of people, a lot of good people, got people in jobs, they can come and their resume looks awesome, you know, so their skills and experience are good, and, you know, they're really interested in the job, and they interview really well. You know, some people can get trained to interview like nobody's business, and they can talk and this and that, and they can answer the questions and follow a path. And I mean, when you put them in the job, I mean, is there cultural traits and abilities, do they match within the team? Do they match within the culture? Do they match with that job performance? Even though, you know, their resume and their interests and abilities look really great, you know, sometimes it's just not a really good fit based on, you know, some of the key attributes that need to be have to be successful in that role. I talked a little bit with somebody yesterday about, you know, I like to draw pictures for people when I talk about things and what makes sense. And since I like sports, I kind of tend to that way. So I look at it from the standpoint like, you know, if I love basketball, right, and I'm very interested in basketball and I follow all the teams and I love the stats and I watch who gets recruited and, you know, who's in the playoffs. So I'm really, really interested in basketball. I'm really motivated and interested in basketball. And you know what? You know, I can dribble pretty good and I'm pretty fast on my feet. You know, I can do layups. I can shoot. You know, I'm pretty versed. I'm pretty talented, you know. But, you know, unfortunately, I'm only 5 foot tall. You know, so that's my trait, you know, so I will never ever perform to the level of somebody at a collegiate level or the NBA. You know, I'll be in, you know, armpits and elbows my whole life, and I'm just never going to be on top. And you know, my manager, my team owner, my coach is just going to say, you know, that was just a bad fit. So when you look in traits and behaviors in somebody, that's a pendulum you really can't move very much. So when people start looking at people to put them in specific job roles with CFO, and typically I think lately the way I see CFO's roles, I think human resources and talent acquisition kind of fall under CFO now.
Very often, particularly in small size companies and growing companies that haven't really established an HR function, yes.
Right, or the HR function is under a direct report to the CFO.
Very true, yes.
So, you know, giving them sort of like tools and you know, good methodology in which to find people for their business is key, you know, because I could be 7 foot tall and
still not be able to get the hoop.
And still not be able to get in the hoop. But, you know, I'm really interested in basketball. You know, I follow everything, but, you know, I don't have the skills. I can be trained on that. Again, if I'm 7 foot tall, I have all the skills, but I'm a nightmare in the clubhouse. I can get behavioral change because those pendulums can be moved pretty easily. But I can't, you know, I can't go from 5 foot two to 6 foot nine. I can't move that. So that's what we kind of look at when we look at, you know, the testing and cognitive traits and abilities of people. And let's just make sure that, you know, they fit the model before we even, you know, go to the trouble of interviewing or look at their resume. Let's just make sure in those key attributes, whether they're, you know, assertive, good closers, high attention to detail, rules followers, you know, are they collaborative, are they team, are they, you know, all these different things that are basically how you're hardwired. Can we look at those first before we go through a long, drawn-out process of interviewing and talking to, you know, 50, 60, 70, 100 people for a job? And let's look at those core attributes that make that particular job effective, and let's work from there.
Now, Rick, at the beginning of that, you mentioned understanding and learning the company and the existing people in place and mm-hmm. culture. Specifically, you mentioned interviewing, testing, some other elements. So I'm a CFO. And I have an organization. I have, I don't know, a couple of hundred people around me. Mm-hmm. And I need to understand and learn. How do I learn? And perhaps this may be new to me. And I may have made a couple of hiring decisions that perhaps weren't the most effective. How do I, as a CFO, even come to that point? Is, you know, help me through how I would go. Do I bring in somebody like yourself from the outside? Would I go to my, if I have an internal HR function, is an HR function necessarily skilled at the areas that you're describing?
Well, I think the very first question I would ask anybody in that situation would be, do you have some questions about people? Do you have like a question mark over your head about why isn't that person performing, or why isn't that team getting it done, or, you know, why aren't we moving in a direction we should be? You know, because that's what people have. They have questions of why. Why is that, and will it ever change? Well, you know, you could do a lot of hiring and bring a lot of consultants in and do lots of, like, you know, team building exercises and reviewing and interviewing and this and that. But it's really important, I think, is to, you know, find the landscape of your people. Where are they? I mean, who do you have together here? I mean, who is out there that is, you know, kind of like bullheading together? How come, you know, I can't create teams that work well together? So before I even would think about who am I bringing in, you know, what are we going to do? Let's get a human capital landscape of what our human capital is. And we can do that very easily through, you know, cognitive traits and ability tests. And we don't need to do, you know, really expensive. We just need a snapshot of what it is. And from there, I can kind of judge about, okay, well, I understand that I have a sales team because that falls under usually CFOs and, you know, maybe sometimes human resources, which it typically does. And I said to myself, well, you know, we've got this great sales organization where we're not really moving forward at all. And so why is that? We incentivize them. We give them new products. We train them. We, you know, we tell them we can go on trips. We can do all this thing, but we just can't get past, you know, past the starting line. We have a few people that do, but we have a lot of people that don't. What does that look like and why is it? Well, easily with proper assessments and testing of people, you can kind of find out that, you know, hey, most of my people in my organization just aren't very assertive, or they're low attention to detail, and this job requires high detail, and it's a long sales cycle, and I got people in there that need immediate gratification. So that's just a landscape, like, I just don't have the right people in the right job.
So would that perhaps have been a poor hiring decision? Do people change their cognitive behavior or cognitive thinking through their life? Could a period of stress change that? Or is it likely that it was a bad hiring decision?
Well, I'm not an industrial psychologist and, you know, or a psychometric analyst, but it's typically from just a bad hiring decision. You know, people can fake it good in a hiring decision, like, you know,
They can be a good interviewee.
And you know, be, I don't want to say deceptive or dishonest, but like telling you exactly what you want to hear because they want that job. And, you know, then I guess their resume can be written any way they want and make it flowery, whatever. So you're gonna hire on certain things. And, you know, a long time ago, as I mentioned, you know, we used to hire on, you know, two circles of influence back in the 50s, 60s, long time ago. And that's, you know, interest and motivation and skills and experience. And that was great.
And particularly in the finance function, it tends to be a technical nature.
Technical.
You tend to be employing somebody for their tax skills or their accounting controllership skills or their SEC reporting skills or financial planning skills. It tends to be more their ability at the function of sitting in their desk and doing the work.
Correct. And then you go back to the culture of the team, right? Mm-hmm. And culture is basically, you know, how people behave, think, you know, and reason. And when you have a tax situation or an audit situation or advisory situation, you need to pull a team of people together. You know, I can easily get a landscape of, you know, how these people work together. Are they individual? Are they strategic? Are they conventional? Are they, what are they? So let's put a team together that work well together based on who they are inside. We know their skills are good and all that, but we want people that can communicate.
Sure.
And that's what we provide, is we provide, you know, very interesting data on making sure people communicate properly.
And can those skills be trained?
I would say you can move the pendulum a little, but I don't think you can move it a lot. You know, this is kind of like where you've been since you were 13 years old.
The 5 foot basketball hooper is not going to get up to the 6'5".
Very, very, very rarely. Yeah. They will, even if they are trained and behavioral modified, you know, their tendency will always be to be a wallflower, even though they're trying to come out of the box as much as they want. I'm using this as a, you know, very general term. They will always be milquetoast or wallflower, even though that's okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I said it's okay. It's who you are. It's great.
And you need some people on certain teams to be that way.
Yeah, to be, you know, need everybody assertive and want to stand on the soapbox and give out their, you know, their opinion. You need somebody that's sort of more, you know, on the
more
fence.
Grounded,
more grounded.
On the fence,
yeah.
Right.
So when engineering a team together, that's important. And sometimes you could bring in, you know, lots of behavioral interview people and get that quality of your team. You know, it takes a lot of money and a lot of time. So what we provide is, you know, what Best Work Data does, and I hate sound like a commercial, but it's pretty interesting technology. It's interesting technology and how we use it and how it's available for you, and it's easily understood and usable and actionable within your business. So you don't need a consultant to come in and read it, and it's not a 20-page report on each individual. It's a very quick screened, you know, landscape of that individual or the team. we do this in executive management as well. We have a CEO and 12 people on his team, and you know, everybody's on the one page, and the CEO is asterisked, and you know, all these core competencies and abilities are listed there, and he can see the delta between his people. So he knows that he's high, he's low in details and high in planning, and he's got seven people over here that love details and love planning, and how come I can't get anything done? I'm not giving them what they need. You know, so, you know, knowing that is really important, I think, in a communication aspect, because communication is everything, whether you're building a team in, you know, in finance or doing it in IT.
Yes.
You know, we provide something that's very unique in that respect, where it's a really quick snapshot. And it's online, so anybody...
It's an online test.
It's an online test, and the data stays online. It doesn't stay in some drawer in some HR department. And so that a VP of sales can go in there and go in there and go, okay, well, I'm going to look at, you know, Bobby, Joey, and Sarah today and find out, you know, because I'm going to have interview them, a job performance interview with them today, and I'm going to make sure that when I communicate with them, I know how they think. So I can ask some questions, and we can talk about, you know, challenges you're having, and see if there's anything we can do to help you. And same way with coaching and training. If I have a team of salespeople and we're going to spend $50,000 on a training program, and we're going to send them to some hotel for a weekend and get them trained, and we're doing training on, you know, process and relationship building skills or you know, whatever the training would be. We might want to set up as breakout sessions and send those people who need help in those areas to those breakout sessions, instead of sending somebody over there that's just going to sit there and go, my gosh, I really don't need to know all this. I know I'm pretty good at this already.
If you've given them the testing and they know that they have an area of need for that.
So, and it's like I said, the assessment test, the inventory, potential inventory or personal inventory thing we give is so fast and effective and economical that it makes sense for people to do it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that software that you've described and helping a company to hire the right person. What do they do? Would they normally get their entire team to perform these tests? I mean, for example, let's say a CFO of a small company may have 2, 3, 5, 10 people, but the CFO of a, you know, multinational company may have several thousand in the finance department.
Right.
How do you go about it from the small company? Maybe let's start with the small company. Would you normally do a 360 type, everybody take the test?
Well, it's really interesting, because I think, more importantly, the smaller companies have more at risk.
Okay.
By hiring the wrong person, right? Because, you know, a 5-person team, you hire one person, that's almost 20% of your inventory. So you got to make sure.
And one bad apple can turn the books,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And then on a larger scale, if it's 1,000 people and I need to hire, you know, 100 people a year, and if out of those 100 people, if I hire 50 people that aren't bad, I mean, that's still a significant, you know, significant number. So I guess to get back down to your question is like, if it's a smaller organization and he's just hiring 3 or 4, you know, to do, we have to ask him, because we're not consultants. We'll ask him, like, what are the key attributes and what makes people successful in the roles you're looking for? Do you know what those are? And he says, well, you know, we just hire on experience and, you know, the interview process. So, well, that's interesting. I said, well, how successful are you? He says, well, you know, we do pretty well. We do get some that don't get in there, but, you know, don't get it and don't perform. And we have to figure out, you know, I either put them in another place or, you know, let them go and hire somebody else. And I, you know, well, you know how expensive that is, right? You know,
sure.
Time, energy, training and everything, and to redo that process. And most people say, well, I kind of do. Well, it's usually 1 year's base salary.
Yes.
You know, it's really expensive. And So if you don't know what that looks like, we probably should do an inventory.
And would the CFO start with him or herself?
I would never really interview a decision maker. I would ask him, like, you know, let's look at 5 people in your organization. You know, you can pick them at random in that business unit. I don't want somebody in finance, and I want somebody in the back office. I don't want somebody marketing. Let's look at the areas where you're hiring. And let's see, like, and you know, basically on the stats, you know who the people are performing. So let's get some people that are performing. Let's get some moderate performers, and let's get some people you have questions about. And let's do the landscape and see what that looks like. And we can put that on one sheet of paper, and we can put it on individual sheets as well for each individual person. So you
can
look
at it.
So
that analysis gives you a key set of traits, if you will, of, like you say, the high performers demonstrate X, the medium performers demonstrate Y, and the low performers demonstrate something completely different.
Pretty much. It's a normalized bell curve.
Okay.
And it's, like I said, it's not a good or bad. It's just where you are.
Okay.
You know, because one of the things we...
You'd plot in each of these people on that bell curve.
That's correct. Because one of our mission statements is to, you know, show everybody their strengths and not their weaknesses, so they can lead themselves through their strengths and not their weaknesses, and so they can communicate with better with people. So, you know, it's not bad that they're low assertive. It's not bad that they're, you know, high on reasoning. It's just, and that's not that bad. It's just like, where do you need to be for people to be successful in this job role? So we go through that, and then we give them that back, you know, as an inventory, and it's really cheap, and it's cheap. I hate to say cheap. You know, reasonable and fast. And he can say, okay, well, I have these benchmarks now. I have these like core traits and abilities that I must have for these people to be successful. I kind of equate it to a baseball manager or an owner looking for a new shortstop. And I said, well, you know, what are those key factors that you must have as that shortstop? Well, you know, he's got to field ground balls like all the time. I mean, he's got to be like 99.9% of the time fielding ground balls. Great, that's one. Then he has to throw the first base constantly, fast, accurately. That's a core trait. That's an attribute he must have. And he must be fast on his feet because he's got to move left, right. And it says, okay, well, when I'm looking at new shortstops, let's look at those things. That how well are they on the bell curve of doing those things? I know these are skills and experiences, but I'm just using this as an example
okay.
of a core trait or ability in a dynamic way. And then... where do these people match up on those in that performance realm? So it could be in a sales organization of something that's fairly highly competitive, long sales cycle, very consultory, and you want somebody that's assertive, good with details, good with, you know, a long sales cycle, somebody that has attention to detail. And if they're over on the positive side of the bell curve, you know, that might be somebody you want to put in the yes pile. And if they're on the other side of the bell curve, or more they have two out of those three or you know, two of those five or three of those five, that's probably somebody that you probably have some questions about and probably don't want to go through the process. So it's a screening, sort of a fast screening way of, you know, just setting people aside, good or bad. It's just where you are. And
so you would have maybe the final couple of candidates that you were looking at, if they were a similar skill set and so forth, you'd put them through the testing. And does the cream rise to the top? You get a sense of the high performer from the quantitative results?
Well, actually, we test everybody.
Okay.
So if I have a job opening that's maybe getting 100 resumes, one job opening, I mean, how do we manage that? I mean, do we have to read each resume? Do we have to make a phone call on almost every one? No, they all take the test. Every applicant takes the test. Why? Because one, that data is going to stay with, that's his data. He can take that to any company he wants. Two, he gets an immediate jobs strengths report for free, so it's a positive experience for him. He knows, oh, I'm good at this, 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 and this, so it kind of reinforces what he does and who he is. But it's really a screening benchmark, so it's basically a no bad hires. You know, we have a platform that ensures that you don't have a bad hire in your business.
And so from the employer perspective, you've now taken a pool of candidates and you've helped qualify them.
We've helped qualify them, not from skills and experience or motivation, but basically their core attributes, how they're basically wired inside. It's kind of like, you know, there's, I hate to use these other terminology, but this is what I do. You know, there's in every job and every job position, people hire ducks and hawks and eagles, right? All we do is remove the ducks from your view so that you can focus on the hawks and eagles. Those are the people you want in your business. So that's what cognitive testing does. It kind of like removes those people that our tendencies are hard at doing those particular jobs and those particular attributes. They're, you know, they either sell first or they develop a relationship first, or they're, you know, they fake it good or they don't. I mean, these are just things that people are. And then, like I said, I keep saying it's not good or bad. It's just who you are.
It's just who you are.
And sometimes in job roles, you need people that need immediate gratification and, you know, that are less conventional in thinking, more strategic in thinking. So it all depends what you're looking for to make that job performance perform well. And we look at it from a cognitive traits and ability standpoint.
So, Rick, as we expand upon building this workforce out, and now we've got teams, and now we're looking at the team dynamics, mm-hmm. what are the biggest mistakes that CFOs and perhaps other business leaders make in this aspect of recruiting and team building?
Well, I think it boils down to management, managing your team, and knowing who's on your team, and knowing how to communicate with those members on your team. And we have another function that's called Manage Me. So it's basically a report that the manager would get that kind of tells me how I can communicate with these people on a more open and honest and relative basis. And I can say that, you know, when John sits down in front of me, I know he's a little bit on the sensitive side. So I don't drill him on, you know, making him feel uncomfortable. So I think just using information to its benefit on how to manage your team and implement them in specific strategically ways.
Strategic ways.
Mm-hmm. It's a little early this morning. strategic ways that I think that promotes good collaboration. It promotes finding people who are having a little bit of trouble, mm-hmm. and if you hire the right people, you can say, well, you know, you're having a little trouble in there. Let's get you some training. And I know that, you know, I can just give you this manual and you'll read it through front to rear. Or, you know, I can give you this manual and I know I need to have somebody sit down with you and go through this with you because you're more of, you know, you need to be led through the process. And this information gives you those tools on how to do that. So back to your question, you know, larger teams, managing larger teams, getting them to perform at a better rate, it all boils down to having the right manager who managed properly. And we have, you know, hiring a good manager is key to every business, you know, and people who we talked about this the other day about a sales organization and having 15 people in a sales organization. You have your sales manager and all of a sudden there's a VP position open and the sales manager gets moved to the VP slot. Okay, I need a new sales manager for 15 people.
New manager probably was the best salesperson.
Yeah, where's the key pool? Well, who's our best salespeople? He'd probably be our best manager. Well, not always. You know, he could be a hunter killer, loves the tactical part of going out there and making it happen, just loves that. And you know what? He may think, you know, I want that corner office and I want that thing on my business card, and having that 20% raise and a little bit of this on the back end would really be great. It would really help my family. But, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 months down the road, he is miserable. And the people under him are miserable because he's not managerial people. He loves the hunt. He loves to go out there and make it happen. So,
and sometimes an individual doesn't necessarily know excuse me, the expectations of the job until they're actually in there.
That's correct. So, you know, managing people require, you know, certain things. And if a company had the landscape of what those things are, what those things are expected, then it's very easy to find somebody in their team that qualifies for that, or go outside the pool and find somebody that can do that on a better, you know, better standpoint.
And we often find, particularly in the area of finance, because we are very often hired initially based on technical capabilities, intellect, and the opportunity to grow our own personal knowledge and help the firm. When you go into a leadership role, your ability to manage people and your technical skills, the balance shifts. And that's true, I think, of all departments, all functions.
Correct. You know, one of the things I think is important is your changeability and the dynamics of your ability to, you know, take on different tasks.
Yes.
And manage them correctly.
Yes.
You know, that requires something that's, you know, that can be trained and learned, you know, a little bit, you know, but if you're more in that mold already, mm-hmm. you know, to juggle various things and, mm-hmm. and have, you know, deal with stress really well and, you know, deal with multiple tasks really well, you know, you're going to be a better manager. You're going to be a better leader. And
you know, can test for that also.
And we show that. Yeah, we show that on a very simple test. Our test is a two-sided test. It's a time test, a cognitive traits and abilities test, and the other side is a behavioral side of a test, and it's fast. So it does take a long time. And the other thing about it's interesting is that, like I said, when people go in and I show them the data on how easily it's read, I can take this to a grocery store and somebody's shopping, and I would say, hey, I want to hire this person to do this particular job, and here's sort of like, you know, his makeup, his printout. Do you think he'd do well on that job? And they could actually look at this thing and go, no, I don't think so. Based on this report, he'd fail miserably because, you know, he is he's not a rules follower and he's low on people skills, and you know, so it's very, very easily understood, and I think that's what makes our value so much better.
Got it. Well, in today's, I'm going to switch topics slightly because we're clearly in the downside still of an economic slump.
Sure.
And just in today's economic times, many employees are staying in the current position with the employer through fear of the unknown. They don't want to move. They, you know, better the devil you know, if you will. And we see that the usual movement of workforce that typically is going to happen isn't happening, and it's somewhat stifled. What would you say to employers and employees given the current set of circumstances? Because the employee may be feeling, oh, I know I'm in a wrong fit. Do you have any guidance for that person?
Well, I would throw a caution to the wind right now, because you're absolutely right. People are more hesitant to move, and even if they're in a bad position or being managed poorly, you know, they're still hesitant to get out there and make a change based on the unknown. And I think there's a huge gap right now going on in this succession planning world with companies, and people are worried about, you know, who in their organization are they going to move up. I think there's a generational issue too. But back on track on your question.
Yeah, we hear that we find that the Gen X and the Gen Y and the new millennium babes, as they're called, they tend to be much less loyal to the employer, because their mums, their dads, their friends, their family have essentially been laid off, if not once, two, three, four, five times. And they really don't think too much about upping and leaving. But right. But the older generations, there's almost a little bit of there can be a lot of discomfort in just even considering that sort of a move.
Yeah, and my advice to, you know, corporate America companies that are, you know, having people there, they're holding them and this and that. And you know what? When things do heat up, and when hiring gets back on and the economy starts racing around, people are going to be exiting left and right.
Yeah.
And you know
yeah.
what that costs in a company? Huge amounts of money.
And okay? It's around the corner.
It's around the corner. So what do you have to do right now? We have to do a strategy on retention, you know, how to incentivize, how to keep people in your business, how to manage them better, how to make them perform better, how to make them feel like they want to stay. Okay. And that's all boiled down to, like, you know, figuring out and communicating with them on a better level. And, you know, putting people in the right places where they perform. And when you perform and you're incentivized and you feel good, you're going to stay. You're not going to look around. So anything a company can do right now to prepare themselves for the inevitable, which will be hopefully shortly, when people will be looking to exit and go for another opportunity, that their people won't want to do that, because they have been managed well and they do have them in places where they're performing.
Sure. Well, do you have any advice or suggestions on key activities that a CFO or a leader can take to help motivate their teams? You mentioned incentivizing, and you're talking about comp plans. You're talking about other aspects of motivation. Are there any thoughts of wisdom that you see employers that you meet these days? Any kind of tips or suggestions that unique areas that people are using to motivate their teams? Because very often, I say that because very often in today's market, the employer may not have spare cash.
That's true. And, you know, without cash, you can still do a lot of great stuff. A lot of great stuff. And I think, you know, it just boils down to what I think I've been saying all along. It's understanding your people and being able to communicate with them properly. And if you're a poor communicator and you're managing, you're a CFO or a CEO, and you can't communicate with your team or the people below you, you know, people are just going to wonder what's going on.
So go learn.
Yeah, go learn and improve yourself some way or another, and show your employees that you care, you know, and they're important in your business, you know, to build loyalty. All those things are important. I'm not talking about anything that anybody doesn't really know already, you know, but people think about, well, you know, it'll just happen. You know, they're being, you know, just kind of lazy about it. You know, we're just going to go on the same path we've been going down, and everything will be fine. When things ramp up, you know, the economy will come back and we'll be on, you know, on the top of it again. But they don't really realize that, you know, people will be exiting.
Sure, sure.
So my advice would be is just, like, you know, even if you're low on cash, there's other ways to, you know, bring your teams together. Whether it's, you know, like doing an exercise program or you know, just doing some
letting
sort of
charity.
Letting them
leave early on a Friday sometimes.
Let them telecommute more if they have to. Mm-hmm. Just find ways to make them feel like you care about them.
Sure, sure.
And I think that's important.
Sure. Well, I hate to say this, Rick, because the time today has just run from us very tremendously. We've come to our last question, and we have a tradition on the show to ask our guests what is their CFO tip of the month. So I'm going to put you on the spot. You're sitting in front of the CFOs of the world. So what is your tip to them?
That's tough because I'm not a financial guy, you know, and I guess CFOs, let's see.
And very often we find that the financial person, to your point, they've been hired to a level of leadership that perhaps is the first time and they're growing into that. They may not even have had mentoring or training themselves.
Yeah, that's a hard one, Lorraine. I struggled with that when you told me about it a little bit earlier and what to say. I would say probably most CFOs that I know are sort of accountant backgrounds. You know, they're CPA, you know, strategic sort of guys. And
Technical people.
They're a little dry most of the time. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying it's basically what it is. So I would probably recommend that they work on their people skills. They work on, you know, being more gregarious and more open. And you know, because I'm a people guy, so I don't look at the numbers too much. I mean, I drive my business by making sure that people are happy and be open and be accepting. Have an open door policy. Don't, you know, just shut your door and run off and, you know, here, this is our task for the day and I'm going to go shut my door and I'm going to go do my stuff. You know, just be open and welcoming. Let people come in and you know, give their opinion. It's you know, it's team building 101. It's you know, not being dysfunctional, be functional. You know, don't be, you know, proactive. Don't be reactive. Be proactive. It's, you know, all those good things about leadership. So I'd say most CFOs have a little tendency to be a little bit too dry and too stuffy. So I'd say open up a little bit and, you know, have some fun.
Guilty as as mentioned. Okay. Well, Rick, it's been a pleasure having you. That was a great tip, and I've really enjoyed having you on the show today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lorraine. It's really been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
And thanks also to our contributor for the news article, chiefexecutive.net. And thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, please go to DelaneyLLC.com. And thanks also go to National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. See their website at nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. And thanks for listening in today to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.